In the world of law, sometimes, particularly in employment law, you will see there are certain law firms on the employment side, they only represent management. And then there are some lawyers, and they say they only represent executives. And so Brian is from, I think probably the best firm in Boston for the representation of senior executives. He concentrates his practice in employment law and executive advocacy. He handles a wide range of matters, including discrimination, retaliation, whistleblowing, wage and hour, wrongful termination, contract negotiations, and enforcement. He was selected by Thomson Reuters to be listed in Massachusetts Rising Stars in the field of employment and labor law for the years 2009 to 2012. He earned a BA from the Catholic University of America, a JD from the New England School of Law, where he received the New England Scholar Award. He was an editor at the New England Law Review, and now he is, partner?
Starting January.
Thank you.
He will be a brand new partner. And the firm, it's Shalepsky.
No.
Shalepsky, Hartley, Rob, Casey, and Michonne.
Done.
We might be adding a new name, but right. We'll see. I'm told my last name's too long.
All right. So we're going to put this microphone here, and you're all set.
We're all set.
Let me get you some.
Oh, thanks. Well, Larry, thank you very much for the introduction. I'm really thrilled to be here with all of you today. I find it fascinating going around the room, listening to everybody, their backgrounds. It really dovetails, I think, into what I hope to bring to the discussion. And it's, no matter what industry you're in, whatever the size of the company, employment law issues, personnel issues, it's just a fact of life. Employment law covers any number of sins. It's the wage and hour, the discrimination, the compliance, the contract, the medical leave, disability, equity arrangements. I mean, you could go on and on. Today's topic, there's a couple of areas. I encourage questions, lively discussion. I want to be more just a facilitator for the nobody wants to listen to me talk for an hour, and I'd rather hear what you guys what I can learn from you as well. Everybody knows when you're at the point of litigation, huge costs, huge burdens on the business, there's the risks. There's also, it's the big headaches. But it's also the small headaches that can distract, suck up time, energy, and resources from running the business, and that they can become the big headaches. So it's really how the company and how board members, how they proactively manage those small headaches on a day-to-day basis that can really impact long-term success, failures of the company. So the topic for today's discussion, it's a board's role in dealing with an embattled CEO who's been accused of misconduct. I put together a short case study that I'll pass around that we can go through together and use as a jump-off point for our discussion. But I'm really interested to hear from the group, kind of in your experience as board members, professionals, and executives, what have you been dealing? What do you see as the common pressing employment-related issues? What are the small headaches? What are the big headaches that you're encountering these days? Just open it up for folks. I don't know if they're issues that they're currently dealing with or that they keep seeing over and over in your roles.
Well, the issues I've seen over and over is issues pertaining to federal rules and regulations, and I would say awareness of those rules and regulations has heightened over the years as government contractors have witnessed the government, in particular DOD or inspector general organizations, imposing some very serious penalties. That's more of an external, I guess, whereas you deal with internal. Sounds like, but that's what I've seen.
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of overlap there too, because it deals with the whistleblowers.
Yeah.
Particularly in compliance issues. That's it's you have the folks whose jobs are to be the ones, the compliance regulators, but it's an interesting dynamic. It's, you know, are they doing their job or are they, you know, whistleblowers for, you know, raising it forward? So that's, I mean, I was thinking today, you know, in preparing some thoughts here, it's a little bit of hot, not hot topics, I don't like that phrase, but, you know, what I kind of see is the current battleground, some developing issues, not new. I mean, certainly areas like discrimination law, it's been an issue, it remains an issue, but I think within there, you know, I've certainly seen some trends, at least in my time practicing, kind of the evolution of those types of claims. I mean, what I see is two common issues and trends. One is in the discrimination world, and particularly because this is going to part of our discussion today, it's retaliation claims. You know, retaliation claims just have a life of their own. It's completely separate from you can have an underlying, whether it's an age claim, a sexual harassment claim, but it's how the company responds to that is often key, because retaliation claims, you don't have to prevail on the underlying claim. You know, you have to have a good faith basis, but your retaliation claims take on life of their own. There might be zero evidence of merit to support an age complaint, but it's how the company, you know, the executives respond to those complaints. You know, I see retaliation, the number of retaliation complaints skyrocket. And that's where a lot of companies really trip up. You know, they might have a very clean, paper trail, records, they've managed it well, but, you know, sometimes when you have complaints from current employees, they're walking retaliation claims, and it really becomes a management issue. The other trend that I'm seeing, sure.
There are different kinds of boards.
Yep.
So let me pose an issue. Let's say we're looking at a family-dominated board or private equity. Dominant board, and somebody accuses the president of having an affair in the office. The president denies the allegation, fires the accuser. The accuser thinks it's retaliation. I'm not sure the president would even inform the board of directors that this was going on.
I'd be more prone to dismissing the CEO for not informing the board than I would be for what he's accused of doing.
Okay, if a family-dominated business, I understand a public company.
Yeah.
That's, public company would be clear.
What if the CEO owns 82% of the business?
Right.
Then it's not a real board. Then it's an advisory board, not a board of directors.
Okay.
I mean, the reality is, I think that, so the point that you raise, if the first the board is hearing about it is when they get a demand letter from counsel, there's gonna be issues. Now, like you said, if it's not a real board, you know, it might not go far. But if it's a real board, you know, they're not just, you know, keeping seats warm, that would be a, I think it would come to, or should come to light, to the board's attention before it got to that point.
How about a private equity dominated board? Does the CEO have an obligation to inform the board?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, under his fiduciary duties and obligations. I mean, because that's, I mean, we're going to be touching upon that later. It's, you know, I'll have a hype out today, the misconduct. At the end of that, you address the complaint and how you're going to resolve that. The next part of it also has to do with, you know, the rights of the accused. You know, you have the CEO, you know, whether his name is cleared, whether it might not rise to the level of unlawful conduct, but the board's not thrilled with this. This is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, whatever it might be. You know, sometimes sometimes it's one big event that just, you know, that's it. You know, we're making it, it makes it easy for the board. Other times it's the series of pinpricks that add up. It's the totality of the circumstances where, you know, and not every board, you know, there's going to be, you know, some folks in the corner, some folks in this corner. So it's never ever clean. But So, just quickly, I'm sorry.
To the extent that a CEO is dismissed,
mm-hmm.
what is, how does that have the effect, positive or negative, on the retaliation claimant?
Yes.
I mean,
that's, you know, there's certainly, there's...
claiming retaliation, all of a sudden the board has just fired the guy.
There's practical...
you're in a pretty strong position for the claimant.
There's certainly practical considerations about how that's handled, right? You have somebody threatening litigation for sexual harassment. You know, an investigation's been done. You know, the board, there's enough here, you know, that we want to make a swift, quick action to get, you know, remove the CEO. Yeah, it's not an easy situation. You're certainly emboldened the complainant. They see what's going on. You know, that's one of the, it becomes one of the strategies, you know, how best to manage and handle this. You know, at the end of the day, you know, success might not, you know, you have to measure success certain ways. Is it stopping the bleeding, you know, getting closure? You know, because, and we'll talk about a little bit, there can be liability for the underlying conduct itself. There can be liability for how a company or board, you know, responds to that conduct. So there can be different pieces. So it might be, you know, might be the lesser of evils to, you know, make the decision, even though you may be emboldening somebody to think that, you know, you're just, you know, you've basically just accredited what I believe, that what happened here, it didn't affect, you know, that there is something here. There's smoke, there's fire. So any other questions on that?
General thoughts or guidelines as to how one should think about approaching this as a board member? Now, I know every situation is different.
Yeah.
And sexual harassment claims are different than bribery claims. And
yeah.
Every situation is somewhat unique. But do you have any thoughts as to how we as board members might go about thinking about how to approach this when you get hit with it in the face out of the blue?
So I think there's some, you know, when we're talking the concept of board needs to investigate, I think there's certainly some general principles that are going to apply across the board. You know, one is, you know, determining whether, you know, there's any merit to the allegations. You know, you want to get, for a number of reasons, you want to get to the bottom of it. Two is, you know, making a determination as to whether, you know, the conduct in question, does it rise to the level of unlawful conduct, you know, or does it rise to, does it violate internal codes of conduct or policies and procedures? You want to get a handle on that. Part of with investigations, you know, with board members, is you do want to have a culture at the company where folks feel comfortable coming forward. You know, it's kind of good, bad, and ugly. The board, you want to know about it. You know, you don't want these things, you know, you don't want the demand letter from you know, the CEO fired me because I rejected sexual advances, and that's the first the ever, you know, the board's hearing of it. And also, too, you know, your job as board members is to help guide, and in these types of situations, you're protecting the business. And sometimes that's, you know, as often, sometimes as it pains me as I represent individual executives, it's protecting the company from liability. Or, you know, at least for or liability or further liability. So those are kind of general principles. And that's across the board, whether we're dealing with compliance issues, whistleblowing, discrimination, wage and hour violations. Those are kind of some common themes. I think we're, if you like, if you want to pass these out. So Larry, does it make sense for the folks in the web land to read this? So the folks
could email it to me?
Yeah, I'll do that as well. Okay. So I'm just going to read through this quickly. So Joseph Brennan is the chief executive officer at Acme Tech Corp. Mr. Brennan is a successful, notoriously demanding manager. For the terms of his employment agreement, Mr. Brennan's total annual comp is $900,000, $300,000 base salary, incentive bonus payment in the amount of $300,000, based upon predetermined performance targets and $300,000 in deferred comp pursuant to the terms of ACME's long-term incentive plan for senior executives, which contains a forfeiture provision regarding involuntary termination for cause, as defined under the LTIP plan. Bridget Crowley is ACME's Vice President of Marketing, and she reports directly to Mr. Brennan. On October 20th, Ms. Crowley contacted ACME's Director of Human Resources, Margaret Murphy, and complained that Mr. Brennan sexually harassed her on August 30th as she was preparing for a big client presentation. Specifically, Ms. Crowley alleges that Mr. Brennan walked up from behind her as she was rehearsing her speech, grabbed her close around the waist with one arm, grabbed her buttocks with the other arm hand, whispered her in the ear that she looked beautiful and that she would be great, and then slapped her on the buttocks two times before releasing his hold and walking out of the conference room. There were no witnesses to these allegations. Ms. Crowley also tells Ms. Murphy that she has heard of a coworker that Mr. Brennan has engaged in similar conduct with other female employees, but she doesn't know any of the details. Ms. Murphy asks Ms. Crowley to submit a written complaint so that she may investigate. Ms. Crowley refuses to put her complaint in writing, telling Ms. Murphy that she fears for her safety and is concerned that she be retaliated against for coming forward with complaints of harassment against the CEO. Following her discussion with Ms. Crowley, Ms. Murphy promptly advised Mr. Brennan of the complaint. In turn, Mr. Brennan reported the allegations to the board. Mr. Brennan admits to the board that he stopped by the conference room on the day in question to wish Ms. Crowley good luck and patted her on the back as a form of encouragement. He denies that he grabbed her buttocks, touched her in a sexual manner, and that he made any inappropriate or sexual comments. He tells the board that this is nothing more than a disgruntled employee who knows her job is in jeopardy after she screwed up the big client meeting. What does the board do next? So, as folks are kind of digesting, thinking about the fact pattern for a second, just a couple of preliminary comments. One, conducting an investigation, it's not just a best practice for companies to do. There are legal reasons and just good common sense reasons, particularly in discrimination world. Failure to investigate, to take prompt and effective remedial measures in itself is a legal claim. Companies, you know, above and beyond sexual harassment, they can be found liable for failing to take prompt and effective remedial measures. The other thing is, as board members, particularly in this situation, we're dealing with high-level executive, it's a strict liability claim. You know, if at the end of the day, Mr. Brennan here is found to commit sexual harassment, the company is liable for his conduct. So it's in the board's interest to get to the bottom of this, to figure out what's going on, because they need to be able to know what their exposure is for the company. So those are really key practical things.
Does the board need to hire an outside investigative body to address this?
Here's where I'd start. I mean, that is one of the big questions that has to be addressed near the beginning. What do you think here? I'm just going to throw it out here. What do you think as a board? What information do you think you need, you know, having heard this, and what do you think needs to be the first step?
Well, she said that Mr. Brennan had engaged in similar conduct with other female employees, but she doesn't know any of the details.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a case I'd go right after to see if he had this habit of doing this with other female employees as well.
Okay, there's some other.
I think before you even get there, you need to investigate her and whether she has a history of any similar behavior or problems in the workplace. What has, in fact, her performance been over the years relative to her position to determine the degree of her credibility.
Okay. Any other thoughts, first steps?
The word that stuck up to me was she feared for her safety. I think that word in itself says you have to find out why she fears for her safety. Do you need to put protections in place? You know, is that a valid fear? And how do you address that one first? And then I think you tackle the other ones after that.
I agree. You know, if you're hearing concerns about safety, before having a strategic discussion about do we keep this in-house, do we bring in an outside investigator, how are we going to do that, to me that's the first on the list here. And it's probably under these facts, it's, you know, Ms. Murphy is the HR person. It's, you know, you look at the facts, it's, she's concerned about her safety, you know, but presumably she's been working on alongside the CEO for the past 2 months when she came forward. But, you know, you don't want to be messing around with this. You know, it's, you have the discussion, you know, if she has directly with Ms. Crowley. If there are concerns about safety in the workplace, those have to be addressed. And then it's a question, it's, well, how do you respond to that? You know, is it, you know, you have to be mindful of both, you know, the rights of the complainant here as well. You know, do you, you don't want to be in a position as a company where you're accused of fueling flames on the fire by saying, well, Ms. Crowley, you're the one who's going out on leave now, right? And that could be construed to be punitive, retaliatory. You know, it, the best practice approach might be, you know, if she's saying, if she has concern, ask her, would you like to work from home? You know, is, maybe there's a satellite office or something, you know, something to keep them apart. You know, you need to get a better handle on what the safety issues are. I think you're far from okay. Is she a credible witness? You know, first you address the safety issue. You know, is it a situation where is it Mr. Brennan who, you know, who's going to take a four-day trip? You know, he's going to be working from home for 4 days while this is, you know, while, you know, we're trying to get our game plan in place, figure out what the next steps are to prevent, you know, potential, you know, concerns about retaliation, further exposure there. But that's, I agree, that's one of the first big things here, based on this fact pattern, is going to handle, are there genuine safety issues and what steps need to be taken there. The next thing I see, the big strategy question is, it's, you know, everybody's in agreement on the board, we need to investigate this. It's, who the heck's going to investigate this?
It should be the HR person.
Well, I think, so here's what I say, you know, my take on these is, there can't be a cookie cutter approach to investigations. And one is, you have to take into effect the nature of the complaint, the nature of the complaint itself. You know, not every complaint's going to be, if it's somebody complaining about a bad performance review, you know, relatively speaking, it's, you know, it's not as significant as some of these facts here about physical touching, sexual harassment. I do think you have to take into account here, it's the director of HR here reports directly to the CEO. I think there's at least an appearance of a potential conflict of interest there. Whether it's genuine or not, it is. Now, in many situations, I would agree, it's 100%, you know, HR should be that front line of defense conducting the investigations. Here, there's a couple issues that give me pause as to why I would say, Ms. Murphy, you should be the one to, you know, steer this investigation. One, it's, she reports directly to the CEO. I think that has to be a big piece of it. I think also, too, part of it is, you know, it raises questions about, you know, as a board wanting to get to the bottom of this, you know, every company is going to be different. Is, does, you know, whether it's in-house counsel or senior HR person, is this the CEO's right-hand person, the person that you're asking to do the investigation? I think there's some optical issues. I think in this, another fact that may kind of change my opinion here is, you know, if we kind of alter the facts a little bit, kind of Ms. Crowley says, you know, I have no intention, I don't want to pursue any claims, I just want to work in an environment, you know, I just want to be free, you know, people understand and address it, and I just want to keep, put my head down, do my job, and don't want this. As opposed to, if HR is hearing about this allegations, is if it's a demand letter from counsel, you know, that also comes into play. It's, you know, if the sense is litigation here is imminent, you know, is this the point where we bring in counsel, either inside counsel or outside counsel right away? You know, if litigation's imminent, do we want that HR person to be right out there, you know, in the front doing the investigation? Certainly, here we have, it's a current employee as well, you know, current versus former employees, that, you know, that can come into play as who's conducting the investigation as well. I think under these facts and patterns, I mean, there's not, you know, the magic answer, oh, this, you know, it's A, check the box, that's the right answer. I would be inclined to, given the dynamic, the organizational structure here, to be looking outside. And then that leads to another question. It's, you know, on the inside you have, you know, HR folks, some folks have in-house counsel right there. If you start looking outside, you know, one is it outside counsel? Another option is, are you going to go down the road of the third party neutral to bring it in to do an investigation? And again, I think some of the decision is litigation imminent. Is this a case that, you know, we know that this is, you know, we got that demand letter, counsel, you know, the draft complaint is already with it. This is going, you know, I'm more inclined to go straight to outside counsel. The folks are going to be representing you, you know, in the litigation of this matter, and you want to be in that hands. Now, sometimes there are reasons why to use a third party neutral. And when I say a third party neutral, I think where a lot of, this is where my hat in representing a lot of times the individual executives, I think, is helpful to the board. If you're going to call it a third party neutral, don't try to, you know, say, oh, we've, you know, we're bringing in a third party neutral, and then it's the law partner of the company's corporate counsel, you know, who does employment law, and saying that's a third party neutral. That raises optical issues, not calling into question, you know, their role might very well just be, I'm a fact gatherer, I'm here to conduct an investigation, interviews, I'm not here in litigation mode, but the optics of it. I think, you know, a recent example that's been in the press a lot, it was, you know, the NFL and the whole Ray Rice mess. They go out and they say, we're bringing in former FBI director. I mean, how can it be, you know, FBI director? What could be more, you know, put aside your politics. It's, we got this FBI, you know, director, you know, beyond reproach. Oh, wait, you know, he's a partner at WilmerHale who has extensive ties with the NFL. And people were in uproar about, you know, how is this really an impartial, you know, third party neutral? This is, you know, I saw one little article about how WilmerHale prides itself on its alumni and specifically cites to, you know, relationships with the NFL. I'm sure it's not on their website anymore. But, I saw an article that was like that. So optics matter. You know, a third party neutral, there can be several benefits to it. One, it could put the complainant feeling at ease that they're getting it's going to be fair, thorough, they're going to get, you know, on the up and up. Also, two, if this is heading towards litigation, and there is a third party neutral that does an investigation, that can go a long way towards, you know, it doesn't certainly win the day, you know, what this third party neutral, what their, you know, their findings are, but it can influence people. You know, just as hearing, this is the person that who did it was actually an attorney, that attorney's firm has a relationship. You know, if it is a third party, you know, a fact finder could be thinking about that. Okay, a fact finder, whether it's a judge, a jury, whatever the situation might be, having a third party neutral, particularly if the investigation, you know, comes down, it's, you know, doesn't rise to the level of harassment, you know, there was, you know, some conduct violations here, could be potential, you know, helpful. And two, when you're also thinking about when the dust settles, you're going to have to address the executive's conduct, whether it's lawful or not. You know, there's going to be some issues there. And having a, you know, a third party come in neutral might be help you have those discussions when you have to have that hard discussion with the CEO when the dust is settled from the harassment complaint.
That's what happened at Caritas Christi at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. They brought in a third party neutral.
Yeah, so there can be benefits to doing a third party neutral. And others, I'm sorry?
Can you just call the MCAD and have one of their certified trainers and MCAD certified investigators come out and do that third party neutral?
They do. The MCAD does provide training services. They do provide certification. Yeah, and there's folks who kind of market themselves as, look, I've been certified for the MCAD as a third party neutral. I mean, the optics of that looks good. It's cleaner. You know, just to give you an example, involved in a case right now, and it's, and I'm not saying, you know, investigators, you know, just because, ultimately, yes. At the end of the day, does the company write a check to a third-party neutral to pay for their services? Yes. But people are sophisticated enough, just that simple fact alone is not going to be like, oh, they're in, you know, they're on the take, right? It's their business, it's their livelihood. That fact alone, you know, it's, you're not going to get anywhere with just, you know, oh, you were paid for your services, therefore, you know, and they must be slanted. That fact alone is not going to, you know, have a lot of sway. I think certainly it's the, you know, the long-going relationship, other areas, this and that. You know, I had a situation where it's recently where it was company said we're bringing in a. I was behind the scenes. I hadn't even surfaced yet, and it was, you know, allegations were raised. We're bringing in, you know, third-party neutral. And it was an attorney, it was simply just an outside attorney hired, you know, and it already from the beginning, particularly if there's already counsel on the other side, it's gonna give a lot of fodder to already, before the investigation has even started, it's already got a black mark on it. Now there are certain situations where it's, you're not even gonna mess around, you're just gonna, you're gonna go to your outside counsel. This is, you know, we're in litigation mode. You know, you're going to do your investigation, you're going to do your interviews, but you're going to do what you can to protect, you know, attorney-client privilege and, you know, understand what your defenses are. It's not going to be foolproof. You know, be prepared. There's always going to be battles about, you know, if the company's counsel is talking to a witness. I mean, facts are facts. You know, we're not talking about privilege, you know, high-level people, the decision makers, you know, facts are facts. It's just, you know, what was said during factual things. You don't just get to throw this huge, you know, attorney-client privilege over everything just because, you know, attorney was the one asking the questions. So I think based on these fact patterns, I'd be more inclined to move this towards the outside. Under this situation, I think probably a third-party neutral would be the road I would go here. I don't know if folks similar experiences or disagree about any thoughts about how they would look to approach it.
I have a question about, and it may not apply so much to this particular fact pattern, but yep. I have a question about how you deal with the CEO. You talked a little bit about how, you know, the accused user could be offered working from home or another office or another position that removes her from the immediacy of this potential conflict. But thinking about the CEO, and this is different because it is at the CEO level as opposed to, you know, a sales manager.
Yeah.
And not so much with respect to a sexual harassment situation, but perhaps maybe more with respect to the situation in Walmart, Mexico, and bribery, and those kinds of issues. What is your thinking with respect to how do you deal with the CEO, who is, on the one hand, charged with continuing to lead the company,
right,
and on the other hand, put in a, you know, difficult and potentially criminal situation, how does the board think about how you deal with the CEO in those circumstances?
So this is where you, as board members, where you earn your stipends, these are the hard decisions. I would say the first thing as the board is you really need to get your ducks in a row regarding, let's say the allegations are really bad, early indications are there's probably going to be some merits to this. You know, say this is a long-term CEO. This isn't the first time we've heard rumblings about, you know, a little handsy, a little too, you know, inappropriate comments. It's looking like, you know, these allegations are going to have some legs. You know, there's not a paper trail of performance issues regarding, you know, Ms. Crowley. The first thing you think I would advise the board is you really need to get your ducks in a row. regarding what the executive, what the CEO, what his rights are. Obviously, you start with the employment agreement. You want to be looking at, you know, notice provisions, cause provisions. Do we have enough to set? If we're moving towards an exit, do we have enough to say? I mean, if it's, if you've gotten to, as a board, gotten to the point where it's, we're making a change, you know, these are the things you need to get in a row. One of the big things in, you know, put into the fact pattern is, okay, you have the employment agreement that has, you know, here's his base, here's his incentive pay, here's the LTIP. Let's say the facts are, employment agreement says, you know, if you're terminated by the company for any reason other than cause, you know, cause not defined, you get 1 year's base, 1 year's, you know, incentive bonus. So then you're dealing with cause isn't defined there. So what's the standard that a board's going to deal with? And then you look over, here's the other thing, it's, you know, okay, so we have an LTIP plan here. What else, what other kind of contractual vehicles do we have? You know, are there, you know, in different companies, different situations, are there restricted stock agreements, what are the equity agreements? You know, what are the triggers? What are the forfeiture triggers? What are the cause definitions? What are the notice provisions? Because this, I see this a lot, it's, you have different definitions of cause. You might have every right to, you know, terminate for cause under the employment agreement without providing severance, but guess what? You know, the LTIP plan has a very narrowly defined definition of cause. The LTIP plan defines cause as, you know, conviction of, you know, criminal conduct, etc., fraud, embezzlement, you know, things of very high standard. Whereas, you know, the facts I just said here just says termination without cause undefined. If you, and that, and you see this more than you would think. It's, and a lot of times what I suspect it is, it's, you know, where it's long-term executives, let's say it was a startup company, they entered into, you know, it's this agreement back in day one. It's not the most sophisticated of employment agreements, but it's renewed on an annual basis. And, you know, we change his, obviously his compensation has changed, but these triggers remain the same and undefined. You see, it happens more often than you think, but then over the years you've gotten more sophisticated. You know, you have now, you have the supplemental retirement plans, you have this, you have that, and those have been fully vetted by, you know, corporate counsel and you know, ERISA counsel, all that good stuff. So does anybody know what the common law standard is for cause?
All I know is we just went through this with our town when we chose our town administrator, and we looked at the contract. Our old contracts didn't define cause at all, and so I always thought cause was embezzlement, conviction of a crime, etc. And I found out it could be even for poor performance, but it was never defined. And as we tried to define it, the selectmen in our town were getting nervous that we would make the candidate run away. The more things we were putting into it,
yeah.
So it was getting worse as we talked about it.
I think part of what I said is, you know, so just to answer the question, the common law definition of cause is very management friendly. The case, because obviously you start with the contract. You can define it whatever you want in the contract, and that's going to be what's governed. Common law, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's a reasonable basis for employer dissatisfaction. Grounds for discharge reasonably related to employer's honest judgment, the needs of the business. You know, honest judgment in the needs of the business. It's a very management-friendly standard, the common law definition of cause. Now, it's not pack up, you know, you can get rid of anybody you want. I mean, there's, you know, and this is not, the company makes the decision, neither a court nor a jury is ever gonna second guess it or look at it. There's certainly a good faith standard built into that implicitly. And, you know, these at the end of the day, the factual basis, what was the, you know, the good reason, the reasonableness standard, that could very well be an issue that a jury is going to be deciding what's reasonable and not reasonable. But it is not an onerous standard to meet. Certainly here, let's say it doesn't, you know, there's no smoking gun to substantiate sexual harassment. My guess is, you know, there's going to, certainly physical touching of other employees, you know, kind of just basic standard of conduct practices. You know, there's fodder here from which if a board wants to go in a different direction or move some, you know, I wouldn't feel too, I feel pretty good based on these facts, if I had a common law standard of cause, I'd feel pretty good about that.
And does that mean if you just said for cause and didn't define it, that would be the standard that
would rule? If you had an employment agreement just says, if we get rid of you for any, you know, if they say cause, but it's lowercase c, not defined, you know, the fallback is going to be more times than not the common law definition. Now, unless, you know, not to go way down the road, unless it's, you know, there's other documents that everybody knew within this company, here's what they, you know, have used as cause. But generally speaking, you know, if cause is not defined, more times than not, you're going to be looking towards the common law definition, which is not, you know, we're not talking limited to crime, embezzlement. It's, you know, reasonable basis for this. Yeah. So in this situation, but here's the other, you know, pitfalls that you could reach into. Even if you're working with a common law definition of cause, you know, what is the real reason, at the end of the day, it's what is the real reason why this executive is being moved out? Is it, you know, well, if we move him out now, you know, this is, you know, if it's, if there are allegations of an opportunistic board, you know, facts that are troubling for board, it's, well, Mr. Brennan was due to receive he had already satisfied all the criteria for his $300,000 bonus payment. Under his deferred comp, he was due to get another $300,000. Those would have been due and payable to him January 15th. Let's cut to the chase. We pulled the plug 12/31, and we're not going to pay those. There's some potential exposure there from a good faith and fair dealing basis. You know, the optics of it, right? You know, so that is a very important thing when you're getting your ducks in a row, to have a full understanding of, you know, again, it's all about measuring exposure. Because you're, as board, you might be getting it from two sides, right? You might have, it's Ms. Crowley who's, you know, allegations of sexual harassment. And then it could be Mr. Brennan who's saying, you know, look, I'm 62 years old. There's been talk about needing fresh young blood in here. You know, I fear I'm being forced out because of my age. And, you know, I have a bucket of money that's supposed to be coming to me. You know, the board's seizing on this opportunity. And there's no merits to, you know, these claims. So these are all things boards need to, you know, like kind of put under the rights of the accused. You need to think about their contractual rights. You need to think about their statutory rights. One of the points, we kind of jumped ahead a little bit, but hot topics, trends. You know, I think certainly discrimination, that's, you know, but the other is for executives, it's the Wage Act. You know, at the high level, it's the common things I'm seeing here. It's a very unforgiving statute, the Massachusetts Wage Act, and why there's an awful lot of litigation under the Massachusetts Wage Act is because it's mandatory treble damages. So let's say there's a claim here, so for the $300,000, we'll call it the annual incentive payment. I hit all the triggers, it's due and owing. To me, that $300,000 that can go to $900,000. Plus there's an attorney's fees provision. So they can get $900,000 plus their attorney's fees. Now, I kind of drafted this the way I drafted it. I put the word bonus in there. This is one of those hot topic issues. You know, it's very clear, you know, regular salary, of course, a wage. The statute's clear, you know, commissions that are definitively determined, due and owing, a wage. Vacation pay, a wage. Where you see a lot of battleground, it's things that are called bonuses but really look like commissions, you know, in essence. It's these, you know, clearly laid out criteria that all the contingencies have been met and satisfied, and say the only thing that hasn't happened yet, it's, you know, it's going to be paid on January 15th and I just have to be here on January 15th to get it. That's where you see a lot of battleground. You know, clear under the law, you know, discretionary bonuses. That's why you see all these in our discretion, when we decide, you know, this, that's, you know, in large part, it's because of the potential, you know, the Wage Act issue. You know, there's still underlying contract issues about whether, you know, you're deprived that payment if that's, you know, bad faith. But the the more exposures under the Wage Act. If it can be established that that is in fact a wage, you know, even smaller claims, we talk about small headaches, this is, and it doesn't just apply to executives, it applies all up and down the organization. Something silly like vacation pay. Let's say Mr. Brennan here is, you know, he has 4 weeks per year vacation, or when he's terminated, he's got 4 weeks of unused but accrued vacation. That's $25,000. That has to be paid to him at the time of termination. So that $25,000 just became $75,000 plus attorney's fees. And the statute, it's not about intent, whether they're trying to deprive him of it. It's just, it's a wage. It's entitled. He has to be paid it. He has to be paid at a specific time, particularly with vacation pay. Any more, any questions about the...
We have about 7 minutes.
I'd like to raise an issue that ties, to tie this in. The format for this meeting was, you have a crisis.
Yep.
Your CEO is at risk. What is the board going to do? That sort of prompts the question, what's the most important things to the board, to the company? Is it the legal implications? Is it how much money it's going to cost? That's important. But I think even more important to that is, what does this mean in terms of the reputation of the company if it's true? What does this mean in terms of the impact on other employees if it's true? What does this mean in the impact of the culture of the company if it's true? We had a situation recently, well, 3 or 4 years ago with HP, if you recall. It wasn't with an employee, it was with a woman that was a publicity representative, third-party publicity representative, but it involved the CEO of HP. They had to face the same problems. I wondered where the legal implications were in terms of priority. To me, the most important thing when dealing with these things is to be sure that it's true, that is, do the research. Were there many, were there other women that also, once you contacted them, said, yes, the same thing happened to me? So get your facts straight and act to protect the reputation of your company, the reputation of your culture, and the impact of other employees, which in the long run will be far more devastating than any financial impact to the company that is required in terms of legal fees or in terms of termination costs. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I was really going to say essentially that same point, but then to add another dimension to this, you have the rights of the accuser that have to be scrupulously observed, the rights of the accused, the CEO, and there's a lot of, I won't say secrecy, but not everything can be public if you're trying to recognize in a litigation situation the rights of both parties, whereas the board has an immediate issue with the optics of it, with the reputation of the company, with the impact on employee morale, corporate culture, and everything else, that they need to try and understand and try and manage when the facts cannot be all known. By the time the litigation rolls out, it may be too late, or it's suboptimal in terms of trying to manage the impact that can be much greater than the actual check you have to write, or the impact on the company, on the CEO himself, can be much greater than those impacts, and should have been, could have been, maybe could or could not have made a bad situation at least neutral, or turn it into a positive. But if you have to wait for litigation to wind its way through before you can say anything to anybody because it's being litigated, then the board has a real problem, potentially, with the public, with customers, with suppliers, with their all the other employees, with the culture issue, and potentially others who may be standing in line waiting to see how this litigation goes in case they want to jump on the train. So the board, seems to me, needs to find a way get their arms around what the exactly what you said, and what the greater impact could be on terms of the business, And it seems to me that the inability to say a lot about a litigation situation because of the rights of the accused and accuser is a real issue for a board.
Well, I think, I'm sorry, you know, certainly you're going to want to be, you know, certainly with respect to the individual coming forward with a sexual harassment complaint, I mean, that is not, you're going to want to be very careful about protecting her privacy in that respect. At the end of the day, you know, the CEO, you know, board members, the company in general, I'm going to say, there's a conditional privilege, you know, if you have to say things in, you know, the best interest of the company to move forward. Now, should, you know, is that best practice to be out there and airing dirty laundry? No. But if you have to give expression, you know, and you have investors clamoring to know what's going on, it's, you know, you can likely, and through appropriate channels, communicate. I mean, I think what happens a lot of times, it's, you know, every board's different. You know, sometimes whether it's the board or a small committee of it, you know, really become the ad hoc day-to-day management team. And I agree with you, the legal piece of it is just, it's one piece of it. I'm not suggesting it's the biggest piece of it, but it's one piece of the puzzle. And at the end of the day, it's the decision makers, the business people that make the decisions. Now, you know, for business reasons, it might be, we have, you know, we feel very confident we have absolutely zero obligation to, you know, to pay severance, whatever it might be. Contractually, it's sound, but for business reasons, we're going to do it. We're going to get a release of claims, and we're going to put this thing to bed and move forward. You know, we're going to have our CEO. We're going to, you know, work out a transition with him. He's going to cooperate with us. We're going to agree on the messaging. I mean, because the reality is that's what happens a lot of times.
I can discuss a case of disguise where I think the board did exactly the right thing. So think Panera's. It's not Panera's, but think Panera's. And it's the CEO. The CEO is a white guy. He goes to a southern town. So think Charlotte. Think Orlando. And he says to the franchise owner, you know, it's at 4 or 5:30. What you want to do, you want to make sure you don't have any black males seated at the window tables, because that might scare people away. Try to put white women at the window tables. And one of the waitresses overheard him say that and was incensed and filed a complaint. The CEO's perspective was, number one, I was not making a racial comment, I was making a business comment. Number two, as far as my being a racist, my wife is a black female. So you know, it's not about my being racist, I was just making a business comment that's appropriate for the town that this, but the board had, it went up to the board. And the board sort of said, you made a mistake, and you have to take some mandatory classes in sexual sensitivity and leadership coaching. And the CEO said, okay, fine, I'll do that. And then the person who made the complaint was informed that the board has taken action, and here's the action was taken. That was the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Good job, Larry.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of times, particularly with the current employees too, you know, because the reality is very, you know, a lot of times employees are hesitant. I think we started out to any admission or any indication that there was any wrongdoing, you know, you just, that wall goes up, you know, if we kind of show any weakness to this individual, that's, you know, that's the end of it. It's going to be twisted and turned against us. I've certainly seen situations where similar, you know, not only the CEO agreeing, I'm going to do, you know, it's company-wide, you know, bolstering, training, you know, and you do it in a way that it's, you know, because you can't always control the rumor mill. You know, in this situation, everybody's going to know about this, right? But there are ways in which, you can roll out new training, new initiatives. You tell this individual, here's what we're doing to address the, you know, those can go a long way. That helps. Not only it's, you know, an optical thing, but it's the right, the ethical thing, you know, to do. So I'm sorry, there was a...
How are you seeing social media change this? And is it now escaping outside the company? So, I mean, you brought up the issue of reputation.
Yeah.
Seeing that change and evolve.
So, yeah, you see, it's hard to control the rumor mill, the blogs about, you know, rumors about so-and-so's out and this and that. It's a real issue. It opens, exposes folks to, you know, defamation claims, tortious interference claims. I mean, it is a real issue.
How many of those actually come forward?
I'll have one more comment from 6 o'clock.
I'm sorry?
How many of those defamation of characters actually get brought to fruition?
Defamation claims are tough. I mean, one, it's a common law tort claim. You know, it's a tough claim. To prove. It's not, you know, if I'm looking into my quiver about what claims I have to bring, defamation's not high on the, high on the list.
So it could be
a threat. Yeah. I mean, you see the claims, and, you know, the defamation claims, it's really, it's the ones that you hear about are the incredibly egregious ones. But it's the close calls, it's the opinions, you know, because right, it's opinion versus statement of fact. If somebody's, you know, giving their own personal views and certain, you know, it's a tough claim to prove defamation. But.
Any other questions? I'd like to thank Brian very much. We will see you hopefully next month. We will have a program from the former partner at McKinsey & Company, talking about mergers and acquisitions, and he now teaches at Harvard Business School. So you'll be getting knowledge about that at the beginning of the month. So thank you very much.
Great, thank you all.
Thank you, Brian. And again, if any of you would like to stay and talk with Brian, please do so.
Ashley, one more thing. Ooh.